This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. On Thursday night, President George W. Bush and Senator John Kerry will face off in Florida for the first of three televised debates. An estimated 50 million viewers are expected to tune in to what many see as a critical event in the run for the highest office in the land. The first showdown will focus on foreign policy and homeland security. As the date closes in, both candidates are busy brushing up on exactly what they hope to say. President Bush spent the weekend at his Texas ranch, where preparations included listening to audio tapes of past speeches and watching videos of old debates. Senator Kerry is preparing for the head-to-head meeting in Spring Green, Wisconsin, where he's been reading transcripts of the 2000 presidential debates and reviewing the president's stump speech. And both candidates have sparred with partners during mock debates with stages, settings, and practice opponents that mimic the actual event. For the better part of this hour, we'll take a look behind the scenes at presidential debates. We'll speak to members of former debate prep teams to see just what it takes to get the candidate ready, and a past panelist will explain how he picked exactly what questions to ask. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about how the candidates get ready for the big face-off? And what do you want to get out of watching the debates? Do you hope to get greater clarity on the candidate's position, or are you more interested in something less concrete in their style or how they handle themselves under this kind of pressure? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now with the first behind-the-scenes look is Paul Begala. He was a former advisor and a debate prep participant for President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore in 1992, 1996, and 2000. He is currently the co-host of CNN's Crossfire. He joins us by phone from Washington. Welcome.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. So where are the candidates at this point? Is this the home stretch, or are they still miles to go in terms of their preparation?
I think there's still a ways to go for both of them. They've been out on the stump. You know, they kind of have their own lines down on the stump speeches. But now they're, for the first time, paying a lot of attention to precisely what the other guy is saying. And I heard in your news report that both of them are listening and reading and watching videotapes of the other guy. And I think now is when they're trying to wrap their minds around not just giving a good speech in front of an audience of cheering supporters, but actually standing with your opponent 10 feet away from you and 50 million people watching. It's a completely different thing.
I'm curious, you bring that up. Which do you think is more intimidating? I mean, you're used to talking in front of a television audience. Which is harder, having the guy who wants to, you know, to unseat you from your job 10 feet away or being on television? Because both of these guys have a lot of experience with television.
They do. I think it's harder to have the guy right there because with both of them, it's the nature of political combat. Is you wind up developing the lack of familiarity breeds contempt, right? You start thinking in the Kerry camp, I'm sure they're thinking, well, Bush is just an idiot. He's a big dummy. Well, the truth is, he's not. And he's a particularly gifted debater. Of all the tools in his political toolkit, his debating skills are actually the best. Meanwhile, in the Bush campaign, I think they've developed this cartoon image of Kerry as this weak, waffling, indecisive wimp. And I think Bush is going to look over at a 6'4" naval war hero and think, well, gee, he's not quite as wimpy as Karl Rove told me he was.
But when you say a good debater, first of all, what is a good debater in this context? Because these aren't really debates in the classic sense of, you know, people answering questions on the fly.
That's exactly right. In fact, it's not at all a debate. It's more like a joint press conference. In fact, it would probably be better, be interested in what your former panelist says later in the program, because it would probably be better if the panelist just said, okay, gentlemen, press E17. That's the Social Security answer.
Uh-huh.
Right? Press F1, that's Fallujah. Because this format, 32 pages of rules negotiated by the campaigns, it's absurd. These are smart people. You know,
what are they negotiating on? I'm sorry to interrupt, but what are they negotiating on?
Height of the rostrums. They must be exactly 50 inches for both men.
Got it.
The distance apart has to be 10 feet. Kerry is taller. The Bush campaign didn't want the height advantage to be quite so evident. But by having the same size podium, or lectern, I guess would be formal, the Bush campaign gets a slight advantage, even though Bush is shorter, because Kerry has to look down farther to see his notes, pulling his chin down. He already has a long face. They have spent so much time on the minutiae of this that they are trying to bleed any spontaneity out of it. And, of course, spontaneity is what we actually want.
So what do you do as an advisor to prepare people in this circumstance?
Well, it's a no surprises thing. You want to make sure the opponent knows what it feels like to look over the candidate, to look over and see the opponent launch one of his broadsides at you. There's a very good chance that George W. Bush at some point is going to accuse Kerry of being on both sides of an issue or every issue. We know that. But the way he does it, the words he chooses, the gestures and the sort of the persona that he develops when he goes on the attack, something Kerry's got to be ready for. And by the same token, with Bush, he's got to be ready to look at Kerry and have Kerry rip into his record and really attack him, maybe even about lying about war, which is about the worst thing you could say about a president, and be ready to respond to that without losing his cool.
We're talking with Paul Begala about getting a presidential candidate ready for what we've called debates, but are really, a toe-to-toe of some sort is going to happen. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call from Barbara in Vista, California. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your program. I have a question. How important is the image versus the issue? The New York Times had an editorial in which they indicated that the debates, the issues really won't matter to most Americans. They're just looking at the image. How, as Mr. Beluga said, how forcefully they come across. Whether they're one of the guys. Whether they look good. Now, you know, this is what, and then it's interesting, Andy Rooney had an interesting comment on 60 Minutes last night that don't vote if you don't read newspapers, if you don't read books, if you're not, you don't bother to find out what the issues are that right. are vital to this country.
Well, what about that, Paul Begala?
I mean, I'm just wondering, how do they prepare? How do the candidates prepare? Are they going to be discussing the issues, or are they just going to be trying to, just present the image?
Okay, Barbara, thanks. So, Paul Begala, what do you think? I mean, can you actually prepare someone to be a regular guy?
No, that's the thing. There should be no acting allowed in this. Both of these guys, I knew George Bush a little bit when he was my governor in Texas. I was an acquaintance of him. He's a very pleasant guy. I don't support his political agenda, of course. I'm a Democrat. But and I know Kerry a little bit, and he's also a very pleasant guy. And so I think that there's so much hype about it. The problem is, in the history of these things, there's only one time I can think of when substance cost somebody the debate, and that was when President Ford said he didn't think that Eastern Europe was under Soviet domination in the 1976 debate against Jimmy Carter. All the other times, the candidates have either succeeded or collapsed because of style. And I think it's unfortunate, but if you look at the way we in the media interpret and analyze these, if you go back to the 2000 debate, where most people who watched the debate, the first debate in 2000, thought that Al Gore had gotten the better of George W. Bush. But then as we looked over the tapes 1,000 times, and Saturday Night Live did the spoof, Gore's exasperated sighing, which he did do an awful lot when he felt like Bush was either not getting the answer right or was avoiding the question, that became the issue, not whether Bush or Gore had the better ideas. So the style, sadly, matters enormously.
Does that, as someone who I presume worries about substantive issues and certainly talks about them, does that worry you at all? I mean, do we run into the problem of getting, Hollywood acting coaches in to work with people more than policy people who can address serious policy issues?
It does. I will say, in the 4 days before a debate, if you don't really know what you want to do about alleged genocide in Darfur, you're really not going to be able to master that in the 4 days. But maybe a coach can show you how to hold your hands in a different way or how to project your voice in a different way. But I think if I can bang on my newfound profession now as a media commentator, I think it's people like me, I hope not to do this too much, but who overanalyze the style instead of the substance. Maybe this will be different, and maybe Barbara's call was useful, because this is the first debate, that I can think of at least, when we've had troops in the field and Americans dying during a presidential debate. And there certainly is a hope, particularly in this foreign policy debate, that people will actually look at the substance of it and ask themselves who has the better position on this war in Iraq and the other issues, terrorism and the rest. And maybe those of us who care about substance will have a little bit better go of it this time.
Do you think there is a need for clarification? I mean, I guess this is a chance as the debate, the people who talk about these debates and what they can bring to the presidential election. This is a chance where You do have a few more than a few more seconds than the 60 allotted by television commercials, or the minute and a half, or 3 minutes if you're lucky on a network news program, to actually lay out your position. Do you think people really don't get the positions?
Well, I think they get a general sense that, for example, on Iraq, I bet you at least half of this debate will be about Iraq, and I think people have the general sense that the president wants to stay the course. But now we can ask him, what exactly does that mean, sir? Have things changed? We weren't welcomed as liberators as you thought we might. Now we have this new situation. And the same with Kerry. He gave a speech at NYU last week where he laid out a four-point plan. Let's put him through his paces. Let's ask the president if he thinks those 4 points are good ideas or bad ideas, whether they are realistic or not. It's a whole lot better. It's why I do wish that the candidates would just throw away the 32 pages of rules and even excuse the moderator and just put a microphone on the two of them and let them discuss this. That's what Lincoln and Douglas did, and it worked out great. And by the way, those were spirited, tough, negative. They were fun. That was good theater. It wasn't boring, high-minded, you know, Roman Senate stuff. It was really fun, and they were ripping each other. So for those of us who like a good political combat, and, you know, I host Crossfire, I love that. I'd still rather have the Lincoln-Douglas rules.
Absolutely. Well, I don't think they're going to change at this point. But let's look back into the past a little. Can you tell us anything about how preparing President Bill Clinton or Vice President Al Gore may have differed from what John Kerry is going through, or is really just tailoring it for Kerry's particular needs and personality?
Yeah, Joe, I think you have to tailor it for the candidate's needs and personalities. You know, President Clinton, very gregarious. He had a large group. We had to, in fact, have a second room that we would pipe by video the debate prep into. And he would take frequent breaks, and there was a lot of, you know, kind of laughing and joking. And he's just a guy who, you know, he's very gregarious. Gore, more businesslike, more run-throughs of the entire debate, 90 minutes, wall-to-wall, with the podium exactly the exact same height, with the air conditioning set at the same temperature. Gore was a guy who was very interested in having authenticity in his practices. And President Bush, you know, he likes to go to the workout room, it's now, I guess, called the conference room, at his ranch in Texas, very informal. In 2000, they even just, instead of lecterns, just used music bandstands from the local high school. Bush, a much more informal guy, and I think that that suits his style.
We have time in this segment for one more quick call. Let's go to Jesse in St. Paul, Minnesota. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. I got a quick question for you. Is it possible that Karl Rove could influence the questioning panel of the advisors, or could he sift through the material? And is it possible for both sides to overlook the questions?
Do you mean the advisors who's actually going to ask the question during the debate?
Yeah, right.
Okay, because there's just one moderator. Paul Magala, what do you think about that? Could Karl Rove have an influence over, I guess, the first debate is Jim Lehrer?
Right. I cannot imagine it, no. I mean, Jim Lehrer has moderated more debates than anyone else. He'll moderate the first one on foreign policy. I'm sure that, you know, both sides have a really strong sense of what's going to come up. I mean, my goodness, we know they're going to talk about Iraq and Iran and North Korea and Sudan. I mean, there's just so many important foreign policy issues that I don't think there's any chance of corrupting or influencing. I mean, the moderators, look at them. Jim Lehrer from the NewsHour will moderate the first one. Then Glenn Ifill, also from the NewsHour, will moderate the vice presidential debate on October 5th at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. Then Charlie Gibson from ABC will moderate the second presidential debate at Washington University in St. Louis and on the 8th of October. And then on the 13th, Bob Schieffer from CBS will moderate the last debate, which will be domestic policy.
Right. Hard to imagine any of those people being unduly influenced by one side or the other.
No, but there's one interesting wrinkle that the Bush campaign insisted on that I would not have gone for if I was a commission, because I do think it'll mess things up. The debate Washington University on October 8th that Charlie Gibson hosts.
Paul, I'm sorry. We're just about out of time. I have to interrupt. Thanks very much. Paul Magala was a former advisor and debate prep participant for President Bill Clinton, Vice President Al Gore. He is currently co-host of CNN's Crossfire. He joined us by phone from Washington. We'll be right back. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about the presidential debates and how the candidates prepare. My guest for this segment is Ken Edelman. He's going to give us another inside view of what it takes to get ready for a presidential debate. Ken Edelman was on the debate prep team for Vice President Dan Quayle in 1992. He's also the former director of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. He is currently the co-host of TechCentralStation.com. He joins us now by phone from Aspen, Colorado. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Joe.
So you were listening to what Paul Begala had to say about debate prep. What did you find was the hardest part of getting Dan Quayle ready when you were working with him?
The toughest part is to decide on the strategy of what you really want to accomplish from the whole thing. I know that sounds common sense, but, you know, you're starting – all debate preps start the same way, with gigantic briefing books that include everything from, you know, what is the president – what is your view on Eskimo rights in Canada or something? Mm-hmm. You know, all these issues that are just so many. What is awfully important is to decide what it is you want to come out of the debate. What is the magic moment you want to create, and what is the overall approach? For example, when we did Quayle in 92, Al Gore is your debating partner, okay? So the natural thing is to look at everything Gore has ever said and written and everything like that. After long conversations, we spent a few hours before we even began the prep itself, talking about the strategy. After that, we decided not to go after Gore, not mm-hmm. to look at what he said, not to concentrate on what he wrote, because people don't vote for a vice presidential candidate. They vote for the president. So we went after Clinton, or the presidential candidate. So we really, whenever Gore said anything, we came back, or Quayle came back, to Clinton. Now, that was a very good strategic approach, and I think it was counterintuitive.
But that's a simple message, but does that really work with every question coming back to what the top of the ticket says? I mean, why are the vice president?
Okay. The focus of everything.
I see.
What you want to do is for this, Kerry and Bush, they should want to just make a few points that will stick to the viewers.
Hmm.
Okay? 90% of what they say will be lost in, you know, just normal kind of rhetoric. But what they want is either a magic moment of, you know, that it could be a stylistic moment, it could be a rhetorical question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, there you go again, mm-hmm. You know, things like that, that are kind of magic moments, or they want to make a point that's kind of a zinger. And certainly Benson made that, Lloyd Benson made that against Quayle the first debate.
Right, that was when he said...
89, you know, I knew Jack Kennedy, and you're no Jack Kennedy. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing, you want to set up and get one of those, and that's hard to do.
Yeah, now you make me wonder, maybe I shouldn't be a babe in the woods on this one, but do people actually test market or focus group these zingers to see if they'll work and then try to work them in if the opportunity presents?
Well, we spent a lot of time talking about zingers. We never tested them because we want them all to be spontaneous.
Yeah.
It seemed that way. And sometimes the candidate uses them and sometimes they don't. I always thought it was a great idea to accuse Gore of pulling a Clinton, for example, a phrase that I wanted to insert in there.
Yeah.
And Quayle just didn't want to. So I kept saying, why don't you accuse him of pulling a Clinton? You know, just make it kind of a noun, meaning to parse words, meaning not to be very reliable, meaning to be a little sleazy about it or shifty. And, you know, Quayle just didn't want to do that.
Yeah. But tell me, is any part of this, I mean, is any part of this fun, exciting, or is it so tense that the preparation is just a chore?
The preparation is tense because you understand that the stakes are high. Most people don't follow the campaign day to day. It's a blur. But when you can see the guys standing side by side, it's a big moment. For Quayle, it was a very big moment because, you know, people had a very negative impression of him in 92. And he had been bested by Benson, certainly, in his first debate in 88. I think with Kerry, it's going to be a bigger moment because Kerry has more at stake. He's not an incumbent. He could win this election, but it'll take a very good debate for him to win it. He can turn around the campaign on the Thursday night performance, where Bush can continue his lead, but he can't turn it around.
You really think that that's a possibility, that the debate could have, or the meeting on Thursday could have that kind of an effect?
Yeah, I do.
So how does the candidate, or how do the candidates go about picking the people that they want to coach them in this? Is it chosen by the party? Is it chosen by the president?
No, it's chosen by them individually, and they think that people bring something to it. I wasn't in government in 92 when I did Quayle, but I was good friends with Quayle, and he thought that, you know, his staff can contribute something, but somebody on the outside, you know, could contribute more.
We're talking with Ken Edelman, who's been working, well, who has worked in the past, I should say, with Vice Presidential Candidate Dan Quayle, and we're talking about preparing candidates for the debate. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call from Dave in West Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's your question?
Well, I'm so discouraged about having 32 pages of rules for this. It seems to just dumb down the whole process. I don't see any possibility for the magic moment that Ken Edelman's talking about, and it seems to me that the next logical move in 4 years will be, well, let's put screens up in front of the candidates like you do with a piano audition, so you can't see the people. Expressions mean nothing. Style means nothing. The candidates can't even address each other. They can't wander away from the podium. This is less and less a debate, and I don't know where we're going with this. Where does Mr. Edelman think we're going eventually?
Good question, Mr. Edelman. How do you answer that?
Yeah, I say hello to Dave. I went to Grinnell College, which is right
there. Oh, yes.
There you go.
In Des Moines right there.
Yeah.
I think there are too many rules, and I think it would be a great idea to have the candidates ask each other questions. And I don't know. I can't imagine anybody, even as gifted as Jim Lehrer, asking better questions of Kerry than Bush should be able to ask, or that of Bush than Kerry should be able to ask. I think that would make it exciting. I think it would show that not only can they answer questions, but they can ask questions. And I think that's a skill that we want in a president.
Do you think the candidates would ever go for that?
Well, they should. And if they don't, then they should be shamed into doing it. For example, have this commission. I think there's a commission on presidential debates. Just say a year in advance, we want 2/3 of the time for the candidates to be asking each other questions. Then if one of them says, oh, no, I don't want to do that, then, you know, it just seems like he's kind of chicken.
Yeah. Ken Edelman, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome, Joe.
Ken Edelman was on the debate prep team for Vice President Dan Quayle in 1992 and is the former director of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. He currently is the host of TechCentralStation.com. He joined us by phone from Aspen, Colorado. We've been hearing what it takes to get the candidate ready for the big debate, but what about the moderators and panelists? How do they prepare, what questions to ask, and what issues to pursue? Joining us now to provide a little insight into how the moderators prepare is Gene Gibbons, a panelist for the presidential debates in 1992 and a former White House correspondent for Reuters. He is currently the executive editor of Stateline.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit online news publication that reports each weekday on state government. He joins us now in Studio 3A. Welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
So what do you think about that last question and the possibility of the candidates actually going toe-to-toe? But that would take a little heat off the moderator, certainly.
Well, I couldn't agree more with Ken Edelman. I think that the only way to really illuminate candidates is to have interaction between them, although I think it will probably be a cool day somewhere before that happens.
That sort of strikes me that way, but you don't think they could be shamed into it, as Ken Edelman says?
Well, if the debate commission were to propose it, there'd be a chance. But I think the candidates want to avoid as much risk as possible, and that's the reason for all the ground rules.
Got it. Well, you were a moderator.
I was a panelist.
Were you given any, with this, I don't know if there were 32 pages of negotiated rules in 1992, but I presume there were some. Were you given a list of things or topics that you could or couldn't talk about?
No, we weren't, Joe. We had pretty much carte blanche to ask whatever we wanted. But there were certain prescriptions. We couldn't do follow-up questions. We could not ask questions out of order. There were several rules that restricted what we could and couldn't do.
So how did you decide, you know, what to focus on given those kinds of restrictions?
Well, I learned that I was going to be a panelist on the debate just 2 days before the debate itself. And in those 2 days, I canvassed a wide array of experts, talked to politicians, economists, academics, experts in various fields to sound them out on what they thought would be worthwhile areas of pursuit. And then together with the other panelists, and Jim Lehrer was the moderator of the debate, we sat down and game planned the debate for 4 or 5 hours the night before. We met again over breakfast the next day and revised our game plan. And then we met just before we went on the air and talked again about what we were going to do.
And what was your goal? What were you trying to accomplish with these meetings?
What we were trying to do was to ask the kinds of questions that voters would ask, illuminate the candidates as much as possible for the voters. It's a very tricky and difficult chore, and I'm not sure we succeeded.
Yeah, I was interested in the list that you enumerated, that you were talking mostly with experts, and I wondered in a way if the debates aren't supposed to be partly at least about what the public is most curious about or maybe the feels the candidates haven't addressed adequately yet.
Yeah, and that's a very good point, but that's it's tough to do. We had a very limited time to get ready, and there really was no way to assemble a room full of ordinary people and get their views.
Right, exactly. Let's go to the phones and take a call from, Joanne in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
I can't hear you very well.
Oh, well, that's all right. What's your question? We'll turn up my microphone for you.
Oh, thank you. I had just a response to the last your last speaker who talked about the zingers.
Yes.
And he seemed to be talking about them with quite a lot of enthusiasm. I'd like to point out that these zingers are simply a dismissive and derogatory soundbite that rescues candidates who are not intellectually well prepared to answer the question. So that when, for example, it's been said that Bush won the debate against Gore in 2000, one of the things he said was fuzzy math, and everybody thought it was cute. But the fact is, it's not cute. What it really means is that he didn't understand what Gore was saying, so he just says fuzzy math.
So, Joanne, you think that zingers are a bad thing to coach someone to do?
Rhetorically, it's just basically garbage.
Okay.
It's not a debate. It's just another soundbite, another wee bit of, you know, our entertainment advertising kind of way of presenting things.
Got
this
it.
This is really serious, and people need to be able to respond to the questions, and they need to be intellectually prepared. And I was very unhappy when people keep bringing up Reagan's, there you go again.
Yep.
That means nothing.
Right. Okay, Joanne, thank you very much for that call. I think zingers are popular and they get repeated often, but we take your point that they can be overdone. We ask you to join the conversation. We're talking about preparing for the presidential debates. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's try a call from Rob in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Your last caller pretty much said what I was going to say, but I want to move on to another one, I guess. I guess if all these contracts are made between the two big political parties, are there questions that are asked of the moderator asked? So they're basically pre-scripted, and if so, what is the point of a debate without spontaneity?
Well, that's an interesting point, Rob. Let me ask Gene Gibbons that question. I mean, you said that you were not allowed to follow up, and I presume you talked with Jim Lehrer, who was the debate moderator for some hours beforehand. How spontaneous were you that day?
Well, fairly spontaneous. In fact, we had pretty much decided the areas that we were going to pursue when it came our turn to pose a question. But sitting backstage just before it was our turn to ask questions, the debate I was on, Lehrer did the first 45 minutes solo, and then the panel did the second 45. And it seemed to me that the then President Bush 41, as he's sometimes referred to, had not really been pressed on his decision to repudiate the No New Taxes pledge that he had made in his convention speech in 1986, rather. So I decided to pursue that, and basically, you know, came up with the question sitting there, and just went with it when it was my time to ask the question.
So it was a response to what you had already heard. I mean, even despite the preparation, it was more the preparation was more of get this kind of question out there. But you felt that you've had the right one to ask when the time came.
Yeah, we had agreed on general areas of inquiry, but I think we decided exactly the way we were going to pose a question when it came the time to do so.
So do you think that there are winners and losers clear from these debates? Can people walk away with a clear sense of who won the debate?
Well, it certainly has been the case historically. We all remember the 88 debate between Bush and Dukakis. Michael Dukakis was the Democratic nominee, and he was asked a question about capital punishment that was widely seen by the public as reflecting a very wooden approach to government. I must say that one of the things I was struck with was the difference between the reality sitting there in the theater, 10 feet away from the candidates asking questions, and seeing it on television. We all came away from the debate that we were involved in thinking that that Bush 41 probably had prevailed. He seemed most conversant with the facts. He seemed most presidential, in quotes. 6 or 7 weeks later, I saw a tape recording of the debate, a videotape. My son had been abroad for school, and he came home, and we sat down and we watched. I was blown away by the different reality. That was the first time I had seen what it looked like on the tube. And in that case, Clinton was very telegenic and a very appealing candidate.
Strange. So really, I mean, the format is a television format.
Yeah.
Two different realities. All right. Gene Gibbons, thank you very much for coming by to talk with us about that today.
Thank you, Joe.
Gene Gibbons was a panelist for the presidential debates in 1992 and a former White House correspondent for Reuters. He is currently the executive editor of Stateline.org. He joined us here in Studio 3A. We're talking this hour about the presidential debates and how you get ready for them and how you win them and how you lose them and if you can lose them. And as we've just learned, how they are designed not for people in the room, but for people sitting around the country at home in front of their television sets or even, God forbid, listening in on the radio to NPR or some other station like that. We'll continue with this discussion after a short break. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. Today, we're talking about the upcoming presidential and vice presidential debates. We've heard all about how the candidates prepare and how the panelists pick questions. There's another player in this event, you, the audience. What should you know before watching the debates? Joining us now with a viewer's guide to watching debates is Norman Wayne, a mass communications professor at Case Western Reserve University. He joins us from the studios at The Real Thing in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So you believe that there is an art form to watching the debates. How so?
Well, you know, Joe, your speakers up till now gave me so many things to talk about that I have so many things on my mind. I'll only take another 20 minutes or so.
Right. Okay, fine.
First of all, Gene Gibbons compared being in the theater with watching it on television. And, you know, that's an old concept within media studies called mediated reality. The media always changes an event. I mean, even if you're at a ball game, you can't wait to get home to watch it on television and then to read about it in the paper the next day, and you get three different versions, your own, what you saw on TV, and what you heard on the radio. And your caller from Des Moines, Iowa, said that all of these visual cues tend to change our perception of what was said and what the candidates are like. And then he talked about putting up screens and doing all those things. What he was really describing was a medium called radio. And being a big radio fan, I have to tell you that when listeners or viewers watch an event, of course, they get to see it as theater. They get to see the close-up of the camera. The camera invades personal space and gets closer to the candidate than you would if they were in the same room with you. But on radio, you're forced to listen only to what they are saying, only to the substance, and all of the trivia and all of the other packaging disappears.
Well, but even in radio, and I'm glad to hear that. I take this as a plug for radio, and I'm very happy, and that's fine. But even in radio, tone, you can hear somebody taking a sarcastic or offhand tone that you can't necessarily read in a newspaper. So I suspect even though the screen, as you say, is up and people can't see the candidates, there's still a component to this that's stylistic in nature. I mean, even somebody, the timbre of somebody's voice is going to be very compelling in certain circumstances.
I agree with you, but it just focuses more on the substance rather than some of the trivial things in and around the debate, like maybe a stray eyebrow or an expression or even some body language that was even inadvertent.
But you think that the viewer has a role to play here. I mean, what should the viewer close? If you're committed to television, close your eyes?
Well, no. Here's what I think the viewer has to do. You know, in this debate that's coming up this week, and, of course, the vice presidential debate coming from Case next week, you're gonna see the debate, and then 10 seconds after the debate is over, all of the critics and pundits are going to be on the air telling you what you just saw. And to me, that's almost a disservice of media. I'll tell you why. I've noticed that with this age of 24-hour news coverage, I'm there just like everybody else is there. I'm watching news in the making. What I use the newspapers for and what I use journalists and columnists for is to give me a more reasoned estimate of what happened. Rather than telling me what happened 10 seconds after the debate is over, I would rather a journalist goes home, thinks about it, writes a story that's thoughtful and has some background and some analysis that I can then chew on the next morning. You know, when I pick up the Times or the Cleveland Plain Dealer in the morning, I know the news. I know the headlines already. What I'm looking for is some sort of analysis or in-depth discussion of what happened. And I think that the viewer of the presidential or the vice presidential debate has to focus on the substance of what's going on rather than all of the other little tricks of the trade.
Okay, let's take a call from Patrick in Utica, New York. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. I am admittedly a bit biased as a public relations major in college, and I'm thrilled to hear that it's a mass comm professor on at the moment. But I sort of took a different view of the debates of the callers I've heard, as I have a great appreciation for style as a necessity in the debates. I think it adds to the personality and the character of the candidate, and I think it's important for people to know what they're like on a, albeit more commercialized, but still that personal level. And I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Okay, the interesting point. And just to clear up, since I think I finally figured out what mass comm is, stands for mass communications. But Norman Wayne, that's all right. Patrick, thanks for the call. What do you make of that? Is style, should we really ignore style?
Well, there's no question that the caller has a valid point. There's no question that you can judge a person's total character by some of those things that I wasn't dismissing them. I'm just saying that they sometimes alter your view. Sure, body language makes a difference. If a person looks confident, then maybe he is confident. If a person looks perturbed, then maybe he is easily perturbed. And I think you can make certain judgments. I think the most telling things that are going to come out of this debate are those unplanned, unscripted things. If a subject or a question comes up where the candidate really has to think on his feet, I think we'll learn something about the candidate that we didn't know before. As a matter of fact, I think that's one of the reasons that I think the race at Case, as we like to call it, when Vice President Cheney and Senator Edwards will be going toe-to-toe, will be very instructive, because I think there's a lot of voters who are still undecided, and I think that this may be, to some extent, a first introduction to both of these candidates, and I do think they make a difference in the ticket. Sure, you vote for Kerry or Bush, but I think that Cheney and Edwards do have a lot to say, and I think this debate can, and since it's their only meeting, I think it can be an important occasion.
Okay, we have time for one more quick question. Let's go to Paul in San Diego, California. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Mr. Palka. I'd like to try to quickly bring together a number of different aspects that you've talked about, that magic moment, the script versus unscript, and whether a presidential debate and maybe the election itself can be won or lost by a particular question. And that question, in my opinion, came from the audience during the first Clinton-Perot-Bush debate. A woman asked a question. A black woman said, "What can you as president do for me? How can you affect my life?" And as luck would have it, Clinton was scheduled to go last to answer that question. Perot did his usual get up under the hood, fix things. And Bush did his typical, here's what I can do in terms of setting economic policy and protecting you from war and famine and pestilence and all of that. Clinton started his answer behind the podium, and by the time he was into the meat of his answer, he had left the podium and was walking toward the woman.
Okay, Paul, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there and get a quick comment from Norman Wayne about that moment.
Well, again, that was a stylistic moment, and all I'm saying is, as educated media consumers, I think we all have the responsibility to listen to the substance and make our judgments on what they are saying more than how they are saying it.
Okay, Norman Wayne, thank you very much. Norman Wayne is a mass communications professor at Case Western Reserve University. He joined us from the studios at The Real Thing in Cleveland, Ohio. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.